Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 18th of July. Our main stories. One of the world's most feared drug barons, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, is jailed for life. The World Health Organization declares the Ebola crisis in eastern Congo a public health emergency. And the younger brother of the Manchester Arena bomber has been extradited to the UK from Libya. Also in this podcast... One bite can kill a man, but the number of tourists flocking to see Komodo dragons in Indonesia has prompted the government to take action. For years, Joaquin Guzman ran one of the biggest drug networks in the world, the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico. Known as El Chapo or Shorty, he made a vast fortune by smuggling narcotics through tunnels under the US border while fighting bloody turf wars with rivals. Now he's been jailed for life plus 30 years by a court in New York. The 62-year-old had been convicted of trafficking hundreds of tons of drugs as well as ordering his enemies to be killed or tortured. Mr. Guzman twice escaped from jail in Mexico, but was eventually arrested in 2016 and extradited to America. Outside court, Brian Benchowski from the U.S. Department of Justice said his reign of terror was over.
The long road that led Chapo Guzman from the mountains of Sinaloa to the courthouse behind us today was paved with death, drugs, and destruction. But it ended today with justice.
In court, Mr. Guzman complained about his treatment, while his lawyer, Jeffrey Lichtman, said he would appeal.
This case was simply an inquisition. It was a show trial, and how it ended is exactly perfect for that description, in that it didn't make a difference what the jury saw, what they said, what they discussed, what they voted on. At the end of the day, all that mattered was the government's evidence, no matter how flawed it may have been, no matter how many lunatics and sociopaths and psychopaths that it depended on. All that mattered was the evidence, and the jury be damned.
Well, Keegan Hamilton is a senior reporter at Vice News and host of the Chapo podcast. He was at the sentencing.
It was a dramatic scene in the courtroom. It was packed, first of all, with all kinds of federal agents who worked on this case and members of the media who were lining up as early as 7 p.m. the night before to get a seat in the courtroom. And when the sentence was handed down, there wasn't much emotion from Chapo, in part because it wasn't a mystery. The sentence was a mandatory life in prison. But there was still some theatrics and emotion in the courtroom. Chapo was blowing kisses at his wife throughout the hearing. And one of his victims, a former female cartel member, gave a tearful statement where she recounted basically how she barely escaped with her life after Chapo ordered her kidnapped and later killed by the Hells Angels biker gang. The trial was 3 months of cataloging his various crimes, the most gruesome of which was several murders that he personally committed, torture that was committed on his orders. Just recently, some new court documents were unsealed, and there was some information in there about how the cartel employed a doctor who, when they were torturing people and they would pass out, the doctor would revive them so that the torture can continue. So that's the kind of thing that they were dealing with. When his victim spoke today, there was, trembling and real fear in her voice as she, recounted what it was like trying to leave that world. And she said she was told the only way out was in a plastic bag.
Keegan Hamilton of Vice News. PKK rebels based in northern Iraq have staged attacks over the border in Turkey for decades as part of their campaign for Kurdish autonomy. Now, a Turkish diplomat has been killed along with a civilian in an attack in Erbil, capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. Both the PKK and IS militants are possible suspects, as I heard from our Turkey correspondent Mark Lowen.
This attack took place in a restaurant close to the Turkish consulate in Erbil. There were some Turkish staff there from the consulate having lunch. A gunman pulled up and opened fire inside the restaurant. Two people were killed. One is a member of staff from the Turkish consulate. Some reports have said he was the deputy consul general, but that has not been confirmed by the Turkish foreign ministry. And the other victim was an Iraqi citizen. Then we understand that the gunman sped away in a car that was waiting for him outside. Now, the Turkish government has said that they have vowed to hunt down the perpetrators and to work with the Iraqi authorities to do so. But at the moment, no group has said that it was behind the killing.
But it does sound like a targeted attack. Does that give us any clues?
The suspicion will fall on two different sides. Partly the remnants of the Islamic State group. You remember that the so-called caliphate of IS that straddled Syria and Iraq and was once the size of Britain has been crushed. But there have been vigilante, low-level IS attacks in northern Iraq, not mainly in Erbil. I was there in that city earlier in the year, and it's actually relatively quiet these days. But most of the attacks have taken place in a city nearby, like Kirkuk and other areas. Earlier this month, IS released a video announcing the formation of a Turkey branch, and they directly threatened President Erdogan. So that lends credibility to the idea that this could well have been an IS attack targeted against Turkey. But it also could have been an attack by the PKK, the Kurdish militant group that's been waging an insurgency against the Turkish state since the 1980s. It is based out of northern Iraq in mountains there. It is under pressure, as always, by the Turkish state, and it tends to target symbols of Turkey, be they soldiers or military or police or whatever. So an attack on Turkish diplomatic staff, as this appears to have been, could well have been a hallmark of a PKK attack.
Mark Lowen in Istanbul. The World Health Organization has declared the current Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo to be an international public health emergency. The disease has killed more than 1,600 people in the east of Congo, and alarm has been heightened by a case in the crowded city of Goma this week. Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus is the Director General of the WHO.
As a result of this concern for potential further spread, the committee recommended that I declare the outbreak a public health emergency of international concern, and I have accepted that advice. Our risk assessment remains that the risk of spread in DRC and the region remains very high, and the risk of spread outside the region remains low.
Last time the WHO met, it decided not to declare an emergency. So what's changed? Our Geneva correspondent is Imogen Folks.
Well, what has changed has been first the fact that a case has been discovered in the city of Goma. That's a city of well over a million people on the border with Rwanda, a major transport hub to many other parts of Africa. That is a serious concern. The other is that there has been another case, albeit isolated, of a woman who crossed the border from DRC into Uganda, clearly with the Ebola virus. She subsequently went back to DRC but has since died. She was in a public market trading fish in Uganda and was unwell, and they're still trying to trace the people she was in contact with. So those two things are very worrying indications that although great efforts are being made to try and contain this disease, they are not succeeding entirely.
And what does this declaration actually mean? Because they say it's of international concern, but at the same time, not a global threat.
The WHO has been under pressure for some months now to ramp up its response to this outbreak in DRC and to declare this public health emergency, and has chosen not to do so far because it can be a bit of a double-edged sword. It doesn't want to deter trade and investment in DRC. DRC's economy needs support. It doesn't want swingeing measures at airports and borders. In fact, we've just heard in the last few minutes the WHO saying borders should still not be closed. There will be more checks, but they should not be closed. But it wants to get attention onto this outbreak. It wants foreign cash. That's an underlying theme as well, because this outbreak has been dismally funded compared to the international cash that was available for West Africa's outbreak 5 years ago. So the WHO wants more support, financial, more international attention, but it still wants to reassure DRC and DRC's government that the country is not going to be isolated because of this outbreak.
Imogen Folks. The brother of the man who carried out the Manchester Arena suicide bombing 2 years ago has been charged in the UK after being extradited from Libya. Hashem Abedi was arrested there a day after his older brother, Salman Abedi, murdered 22 people at the end of an Ariana Grande concert. Danny Shaw reports.
After many months of discussions between the UK and Libyan authorities, Hashem Abedi was handed over to British police officers this morning and escorted on a flight from Tripoli. He was arrested once the plane landed in London. The Crown Prosecution Service had previously authorised charges against Mr. Abedi of murder, attempted murder and conspiracy to cause an explosion likely to endanger life. Theresa May said it was an important moment in the investigation. The Prime Minister said she hoped it was a welcome step for the loved ones of the victims.
Danny Shaw. The world's best golfers have descended on the rugged and weather-beaten coastline of Northern Ireland for this year's Open Championship. The last time the tournament was held at Royal Portrush in County Antrim, 68 years ago, the winner took home a cheque for £300, about $350. This year's champion will pocket £1.8 million. Our correspondent Chris Page spent the day at the course.
Northern Ireland's picture book Atlantic coastline is the northern boundary of a golf course which has long been regarded as one of the best in the world. In 1951, Royal Portrush hosted the Open Championship on the only occasion it's been previously held outside England or Scotland. The club's secretary-manager, Wilma Erskine, says staging the event was unthinkable when she started her job in the 1980s.
We were in the middle of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. We had no American visitors. We had no money. The clubhouse was falling down. When you look from then to now, we're about to have the Open Championship. You know, it's been a long, faraway dream.
The peace process has made the aspiration possible, and Northern Ireland's golfers have also had a prime role. Rory McIlroy says he's proud the major titles won by himself, Graeme McDowell and Darren Clark have helped to bring the Open to Portrush.
It just sort of shows what we've done in terms of players and how Northern Ireland has come on as a country that we're able to host such a big event here again. You know, sport has an unbelievable ability to bring people together. We all know that this country sometimes needs that.
There's a carnival in Portrush town where government agencies have spent £17 million on redevelopment. Almost a quarter of a million tickets have been sold for the Open and thousands of golf fans are already watching the practice rounds.
I just can't believe the Open is in my hometown. I'm beside myself, as they say.
It's a mistake because it's never been here before in our lifetime.
The Open will be the biggest sporting event ever to take place in Northern Ireland, and organisers have confirmed today that Portrush will remain on the rota to host the competition for many years.
Chris Page. And still to come in the podcast.
I could completely hide the earth behind my thumb. Everything I ever knew, I could hide behind my thumb.
Looking back at the earth on one of the space flights which paved the way to the moon landing. The International Court of Justice has ruled that Pakistan violated international law in its handling of a case against an Indian man accused of spying. The judges demanded a review of the death sentence he was given, but stopped short of approving India's request that he be released immediately. Our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etirajan told me more about the case.
Kulbhushan Jadhav was convicted by a Pakistani military court and he was given the death sentence on charges of espionage and sabotage. So now the court ruling is binding, but then it has no powers to enforce. This case is fascinating because in one fine day in 2016, March, Pakistan said it had captured an Indian spy in the Balochistan province in the southwestern part of Pakistan. And it said he was involved in sabotage because there is an insurgency going on in Balochistan province. And Pakistan accuses India of fomenting trouble in this part. And that's why he was arrested. And then there was a video released by the Pakistani military where he was confessing to spying for India, but then India said no, it was obtained under duress. So, and then after he was given the death sentence, then India approached the International Court of Justice, and now the court has given the verdict asking Pakistan to review not only the conviction and also the death sentence and give him a consular access. And the Indian officials are hoping that this would enable them to go for a retrial in a civil court at a later date.
So is it expected that this review will lead to the death sentence being overturned?
This only asking the whole process to be reviewed, because then the Indian authorities can argue, since this was done at a military court, then we can have access to him, give him the legal support he needed. Then it can go for a civil retrial. He was arrested inside Pakistani territory. However, the Indian authorities say he was abducted from neighboring Iran. He was a businessman. But, you know, both countries very often accuse each other of spying. And we have had cases where a number of people are languishing in jails in both countries and people are accused of spying for the respective countries.
Anbarasan Etirajan. Hundreds of people gathered close to Schiphol Airport near Amsterdam on Wednesday to mark the fifth anniversary of the shooting down of Malaysian airliner Flight MH17. I still cry. All 298 people on board were killed when the plane en route from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur was brought down over eastern Ukraine in 2014. Investigators say it was hit by a Russian-made missile, though Russia has always denied any involvement. The majority of the passengers were Dutch, but others came from Malaysia, Australia, Canada, Indonesia and the UK, a fact acknowledged at the ceremony by the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte.
To all the families from and representatives of the grieving nations, let me say how much we appreciate you being here. Today, we are united in our grief and in our determination to ensure justice for the victims.
Also at the ceremony was our Netherlands correspondent, Anna Holligan.
I'm standing just on the edge of the sunflower fields. The seeds brought, many of them from eastern Ukraine, by the friends and relatives of those who lost their lives. The ceremony was incredibly moving, incredibly tearful. We watched the names of 298 people being read out by their loved ones. In some cases, they struggled to keep the tears away, and in others, they read out the names of their own children and grandchildren. There was a one-minute silence, which ended with the burning engine of a plane taking off from Schiphol Airport, which is not far from here. This is the memorial site, so they've planted 298 trees in the shape of a ribbon to remember each one of the victims. And inside that is where we were sitting. It's an amphitheatre created especially in memory of those who lost their lives. And it's an effort to give the grieving relatives a place to come together. They describe each other as the friends they wish they'd never met. Before now, they were strangers, as you said, from all over the world. They've come to mark this day, the five-year anniversary of the downing of Flight MH17.
Anna Holligan reporting. The European Union is set to launch a formal investigation into how Amazon uses data collected from sellers. Brussels has been conducting a preliminary probe into the company's dual role as both a retailer and a host for rival third-party merchants. At the same time, Amazon is pulling the plug on its third-party selling platform in China. Competition there among online retailers is cutthroat, as we heard from retail analyst Mia Knights.
Alibaba and JD.com, the two other major e-commerce based businesses, are stiff competition for Amazon. It's telling that Amazon was talking about making, I think, up to about $5 billion on its first day of its Prime Day sale. Alibaba will make that in the first 10 minutes of Singles Day. The scale of the Chinese market is just absolutely vast.
Retail analyst Mia Knights. The Indonesian government is considering closing Komodo Island, home to the world's largest lizard. The governor of the region is demanding the shutdown as tourists flock to see the 3-metre-long creatures and hear their signature hiss. If the plans are approved, even villagers who've lived with the dragons for generations will be forced to leave Komodo next year, as Rebecca Henschke reports.
The number of visitors coming here has doubled in the last 5 years to 300,000. Today, there are so many people in the jungle that crowd management is needed.
Each tour group rolls in and is given 5 minutes to take photos and then is told to leave as the next one comes.
With increased interest and money coming in, a tussle has broken out over control of this World Heritage Site. The central government is heavily promoting the area and wants to see 500,000 visitors this year. The local government says it's unsustainable.
Karena banyak sekali orang masuk di sana, lalu
anyone can come in and out, says the governor of the region, Victor Leskodak, and they're paying next to nothing. He's demanding a year-long closure of the island, and then after that, a limited number of people who can pay $1,000 US each can come in, he says. Earlier this year, police arrested 5 people for smuggling baby Komodo dragons. And the governor says this is a further sign that things are out of control.
There will be no smuggling under my watch. It's called Komodo Island, so it will only be for the Komodos, not for humans. There will be no human rights there, only animal rights. Whoever disturbs the dragons will be fed to them, and they will die.
The villagers here say that they let their goats roam around free rather than putting them in any form of a cage overnight and in the day, because they're kind of their protection against the Komodo dragons. If they come in, they'll take the goats instead of the children. The community also says they're protected because they're related to the dragons. Elder Haji Amin, like most Indonesians, is a devout Muslim. But this is our history, he says, not a legend, that Princess Nago gave birth to a man-child and a Komodo baby. So we're connected with the dragons by blood. And moving, he says, is not an option.
We would be better off dead. They tried to move us in the 70s when they declared this area a national park. And the Komodos went crazy. They started jumping into the sea and swimming away. That's how close our relationship is. We will fight to stay.
A report by Rebecca Henschke. Ahead of this weekend's 50th anniversary of the moon landing, we've been looking at some of the developments that made it possible. Just 7 months before the Eagle lunar module touched down, the Apollo program launched only its second manned mission and the first to leave Earth orbit. For the BBC World Service podcast 13 Minutes to the Moon, Kevin Fong spoke to astronaut Jim Lovell about Apollo 8, which took humans around the moon for the first time in December 1968, a rare piece of good news in a year that had seen the US rocked by political assassinations and social unrest.
We have ignition sequence start. The engines are on. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit. We have liftoff. Liftoff at 7:51 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
We fly on the long elliptical orbit. As we go through the sphere of influence, that is, the moon's gravity is stronger than the Earth's gravity, who's trying to hold us back. Dark side of the moon, we don't see anything at all. And then at the proper time, we light the engine, and suddenly we start looking down, and there we are, just 60 miles from the moon's surface, slowly watching the craters slip by underneath. We're like 3 school kids, you know, looking at those craters go by. And so that was quite a sight.
Okay, Houston, the moon is essentially gray. No color. The Sea of Fertility doesn't stand out as well here as it does back on Earth. There's not as much contrast between that and the surrounding craters.
And then, of course, you get around to the other side of the moon and there's something else to see coming up on the horizon.
Well, as we come around this way, out of the lunar horizon comes a blue and white ball, which is the Earth, 240,000 miles away. You know, I started to think, wow, that's home. And as we came around farther, I could go to the window and put up my thumb, and I could completely hide the Earth behind my thumb. You have to think about that. Over 5 billion people. Everything I ever knew, I could hide behind my thumb. And I got to start to think. The Earth is a mere speck in our Milky Way galaxy, and it's lost to oblivion in the universe.
Vast loneliness up here on the moon. It makes you realize just what you have back there on Earth. The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
And of course, the crowning blow was to see the Earth come up on the third orbit, and Bill happened to have the telephoto lens on the camera. He was trying to do it on the right window. The composition was horrible. On my left window, with the lunar horizon coming down like this and the Earth coming up like this, perfect. So I brought Bill over with his camera, set him up there, told him how to compose the picture, and then said, now push that button right over there.
Bill, I got a phrase that's very clear right here. Got it?
Yep.
Jim Lovell ending that report discussing the Apollo 8 mission and the famous photograph of the Earth taken on it. And we've been asking you to send in your stories of the night of the moon landing, and Minter Dial has done just that, recalling his experience as a five-year-old in France.
That night they decided to have a celebratory party with other American friends living in Paris. And the guests' kids were invited to sleep over. With all the hoopla and the noise and excitement, it was, after all, the raging 60s, I apparently found it sage to seek refuge in the bed of one of the guests who was invited over. She was 2 years my senior, that's to say 7 years old. As the story goes, the parents, after the moon landing, trooped into the room to find us in bed together. Apparently we were feigning to be asleep, or at least I was. And they saw fit to mark the occasion with a photograph, which I still have. My narrative goes something like, one small step for a small boy, one funnier step toward manhood. And as an epilogue, I can report that that seven-year-old girl and I are still wonderful friends. Keep up the good work at the BBC Global News podcast. Yours faithfully, Minter Dial.
And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.